You're listening to Mike and Kristen,
the podcast.
I'm Mike, a musician, writer, and producer.
And I'm Kristen, a painter, writer, and designer.
Our show is all about following dreams, taking chances, and what life as an artist is really about.
Together, we bring you weekly guest interviews and thought-provoking conversations.
Let's go! Hello, Kristen Ray Harrington. How are you doing on this beautiful day?
I am doing very well. I actually had my friend Steph send me a text the other day that said, "Hello, Kristen Ray Harrington," and in brackets said in Mike's voice.
Yeah, I do say it pretty often at the top of the show.
That's all right. People know my full name now.
Ray, R-A-E. Pretty unique middle name.
I asked my parents if I was named after anyone, and my grandparents' last name was Rayfuse. So my dad was like, "Well, it's, you know, shortened version of that." And then my mom secretly told me one day, "That was also the name of your grandfather's boss." It was like getting brownie points or something. So
that's pretty random.
I feel a little used by that.
Yeah. Did you ever find out who Ray was?
No. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
There's a new Ray in the hood.
You are the Ray.
What about you, Michael Stephen Ryan, you named after?
My dad's middle name is Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
My first name, like as you know, I'm named after Michael Jordan, which is actually true. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated around the time I was born, and there you go.
Was your mom being wheeled in the hospital going into labor and happened to see the magazine cover? Or
that's the story I'll tell.
Yeah.
I think it was obviously a pretty popular name at the time. Like, there's lots of 40-year-old Michaels out there now.
We'll confirm with Caroline the story.
But dad was a big basketball fan, and I think they just saw the name. That maybe they already had Michael picked, and that was like the final, conclusive, definitive way that they decided on me. But yes, I'm named after Michael Jordan, and your middle name is after your grandfather's boss. But you might
so impersonal.
You might be the only person in the world named after your grandfather's boss.
Well, I don't know who this week's guest, Danielle McGaffin, may be named after.
Danny Mega.
Didn't get into that, but we call her Danny Mega around here, which is her Instagram handle, and I guess how lots of people in the world know her now, but it's become kind of an identity around here. Like, "Oh, Danny Meg is coming over today."
And yesterday was a huge day for her 1 year sober anniversary.
I am so proud of her. Danny is someone who just came into our lives before the holidays last year, not that long ago, but seeing what she has accomplished in 1 year is really miraculous. Not only was she healing herself and on this incredibly challenging journey of sobriety, but she has influenced thousands, tens of thousands of people around the world in such a positive way. Like, who does that when they're trying to dig themselves out of a pit?
Yeah. And she says herself, she hit her rock bottom, like she talks about it in the episode. And that was a turning point for her, where she couldn't go any lower, and she turned things around and went through a really hard thing. But through that and in that, she found this voice and maybe this path and this reason, and she has just grown into this person who is helping so many others. And her social media following is huge. She has a very supportive community, and she's making sobriety fun. Like, she's still having just a blast doing it, and yeah, she's just an amazing person.
Not to mention, she's pursuing a PhD.
Yeah.
She is writing a book.
Yeah.
She soon will be launching an online course to help others through their sobriety journey.
Yeah.
Like, it's just endless what she's been able to achieve. Not to mention, you know, coming out of this darkness in her life. And she's just completely reinvented herself. It's really amazing. Which brings me to this week's Thoughts and Things quote.
Thoughts and things, thoughts and things, thoughts and things, thoughts and things.
So I chose this quote specifically for Danny because it is authored by none other than Coco Chanel.
Okay.
And Danny's a fashionista, and I know she loves Chanel. So here is the quote. Don't spend time beating on a wall, hoping to transform it into a door. And what I loved about this quote is that it felt like this idea of if you keep repeating the same behaviors or trying to do the same things that you've always done, you're going to have the same results. So stop pounding on this wall, thinking that miraculously you're going to have something other than a wall in front of you.
And isn't that the definition of insanity? Like trying the same thing over and over again, hoping for a different result?
It would feel pretty insane after a while. Yes, absolutely. But I attribute this quote to Dani's behavior in that she had it dawned upon her that I need to change my behavior in my life if I want different outcomes, and look at what those outcomes now look like for her.
Yeah, and that's just a good reminder, that quote. Just it's nice to try new things, and maybe you're on a path that you think is the right thing for you, and maybe take a little step back and try a different angle. Or maybe you're on the right path, but just the way you're approaching it is slightly off.
Right.
And you have to approach it with a different maybe mindset, or just look at it in a slightly different way, and you'll get through you'll find the door, I guess, in terms of the metaphor. But that's a good one, Kristen, right?
Yes, I thought that was suitable for Dani MAGA. And Dani's also going to be at Togetherland. She's launching a show there on August 18th, so still a ways away, but she has a virtual museum called Museum of Addiction and Recovery, and this is going to be an in-person show that's inspired by this online platform that she's created.
And in the episode, she does a call out for artists. So she's looking for, it can be Nova Scotia artists or anywhere in the area who have experienced addiction and created some type of art. I don't know if it needs to be around that. I'm not sure the exact parameters.
It's really if you've personally experienced it or been impacted by it in your life by a family member or a friend, which we also talk about in this episode, is pretty common here in this part of the world.
Yeah.
And so it's a really universal theme and meant to be supportive of those folks out there who can relate to this part of their history.
Well, let's just get into this episode. It's an awesome episode, very powerful, very emotional at times. And again, yesterday, Tuesday, April 9th, 1 year sober for Dani. Some big life changes, some big things in the horizon for her, and very proud of her and grateful for the opportunity to sit down and chat.
So much more to come from this impressive woman, and we know that you'll get a valuable takeaway. So thanks, Dani, for being here, and for all of you beautiful babes listening every week.
Woo. You've heard yourself online and in situations.
I don't really talk online, though. That's
You're true. Getting better at that, though.
Oh, I used to when I was a big drinker. I'd just get on Instagram Live and say whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
But now it's so nerve-wracking. Oh, is this how I sound?
Did you have an Instagram account way back when? And is the account that you now have that is so successful something brand new?
I've always been Dani MAGA on Instagram. But before August 2023, it was just thirst traps. Mm-hmm. Of me in, how do you say it, in revealing dresses.
Mm-hmm. Similar to mine, right?
Exactly. Yes. Like yours. Yes. Is currently. Yeah. And that's how I showed up in my life, because I was drinking everything. Everything was about not feeling my own feelings. So I would get any kind of dopamine from alcohol or drugs or men and validation from men online. And that was just kind of how I lived my life. And I think that's how a lot of women can show up online. Yeah. And that's okay if that's how you show up online and that's for yourself. But mine was always just to get a hit of dopamine and self-esteem from elsewhere, not from inside of me.
But this account that you have now has just absolutely exploded with positivity and followers that are attracted to that. So how does this feel different now?
Yeah. Well, so I started sharing my recovery story in, I think it was August. And I'd never even made an Instagram reel before. Again, it was just thirst traps. And I had a friend who had a really successful like study YouTube thing in London. And I was like, can you show me how to use this? Because I missed about 12, 13 years of development of technology with my drug addiction. So she sat me down, literally, we went to Oxford and she just like took all these videos of me. She sat me down. She showed me how to cut them together to music. She made my first like three reels. And then I was like, okay, I can kind of do this. Like I had no idea what I was doing. And then when I started sharing my story, people started really relating to it. And just like, I guess the positivity. And a lot of women aren't super open about drug addiction and alcoholism online. There is kind of like a sober Instagram community, but it's quite small. And a lot of the time people think drug addicts look like the brown bag or the person sleeping on the street. And that's a huge part of it. But there's also a bunch of people who live really double lives and hide that side of them. And that's what I did for 13 years. I was such a broken person and I was working, you know, kind of working jobs. It's really actually just like doing lines in the theater room of the Maritime Museum of the Atlantic. Great place to do cocaine on a Thursday afternoon.
You heard it here.
We're taking notes here.
So like in the end, I wasn't really holding together a double life very well. My drug use got really bad over COVID and I was doing my PhD-ish and I decided on a kind of whim to move to London and finish it there because it was with an English university. But when I got to England, I was just like super lonely and depressed and missed the Maritimes. And my drug use just escalated like crazy, where I was doing it every single day. And I just was barely living. It's horrible. Like cocaine is my drug of choice. And it's huge in both Nova Scotia and in England. And somebody's actually, since I've been home, has told me that it's gotten really, really bad here again. And I think it is a drug that rots your soul. Sorry, this sounds like a drug awareness campaign from the 80s.
This is your story.
Fine. Yeah. this is what
change
we're...
the subject.
No, we'll definitely get into to this, the deepest, darkest parts of it. If obviously you're willing to go
bring
there.
It.
We're not gonna
bring
but
it.
You are a Nova Scotia girl. Born in Hubbard's area, is that correct?
I am Tantallon.
Tantallon.
Local.
I am very local. My mom and dad are Nova Scotian. They bought an old hunting lodge down Wynnette's Point Way when I was a kid, and I basically just grew up there on the ocean. My dad, prolific drummer, great musician. Yeah. Mike McGaffin, got to give him a shout out.
Yeah, nice.
He used to do drumming with some of the Beach Boys. He managed a session drummer, one of the best from the 60s, Hal Blaine, who was in the Wrecking Crew.
Wow.
I was enrolled in playing the flute since I was four. I was number one flutist in this province in my age group when I was about 14 and 15. And destined for that musician life. So I can kind of relate.
Do you still play the flute?
No, because I got my lips done and they're too big.
Okay.
Did you have
dreams
of playing the flute in concerts and band?
No. So, I mean, we can just get into the dark stuff now. My mother growing up, she's my best friend now, but she was a massive alcoholic and a rageaholic. And practicing the flute was turned into a really sort of horrible thing for me because it was the thing, if I didn't do it, there was a lot of anger that would come my way, and my flute has been thrown out of windows. It has been put in the oven and had the oven turned on when I refused to practice. So me and the flute kind of parted ways because it was no longer fun for me.
Yeah.
And then speaking of being a local girl, actually, I was working my first job at the Dairy Queen. Just up the road.
Yeah.
And I was 17 the summer before I was starting at NSCC, and my dad picked me up from work. And he said, all right, well, I just want you to know when we get home, it's your mother's intervention. And I was like, what? And I felt like I loved my mother. I felt like I was betraying her, but we were living in like absolute chaos. And so I just remember the drive back from like Dairy Queen to the house and feeling like, oh my God, I can't, I'm going to really hurt this poor woman that I love so much. But in the end, the intervention went really well. And my mom has been sober ever since.
Wow. And was it just you and your dad and your mom in that environment that night?
No, my a few neighbors and my mom's sisters came. And I just remember like crying. It's kind of a traumatizing thing for a child to go through. And I was definitely still a child. But the really interesting thing that I always kind of share, especially in like 12-step meetings, is that it was I was always like anti-alcohol, anti-drugs growing up. Because when you are around that. But I think it was about a month and a half after mom got sober, I picked up my first drink and got absolutely shit-faced. Like I was addicted from day one.
Where were you? What was that first experience?
I'd moved out into the city. I was going to the NSCC on Bell Road, which no longer exists, date myself, and studying screen arts. And there was a big party, and I had a crush on a guy, and somebody's older brother got us Smirnoff Ice. And I remember being at that party, and I downed, like, those four Smirnoff. And if you've never drank before, that's a lot to, like, a little tiny girl.
Yeah.
I downed them really fast. I remember this older guy at the party being like, hey, you know, be careful, Danielle. Like, instantly, that first time I drank, somebody was, like, noticing that it was kind of abnormal.
Yeah.
And then it was just off to the races from there for a really long time.
Did you get hungover the next day?
No, I didn't get hangovers until I was like 27. So I just had.
So you just drank, had fun, woke up, felt fine, and wanted to do it again?
Exactly. Did my life. But horrible things were obviously happening to me. When I moved into Halifax and I was in my late teens, early 20s, these were the days of the dollar shots at the Dome.
Yeah.
You might remember, and like Toonie Tuesday at Split Crow or whatever.
KFC too.
What?
You can go to KFC. Oh. This isn't booze.
Oh, yeah, shit. Yeah. No, yeah, wait. Toonie Tuesday might be KFC. I'm thinking Power Hour, whatever. So I just started. I was just like doing what everybody else was. Mm-hmm. Like everybody else was drinking the same as me. So, you know, you could go to the Dome and get 20 shots for $20. That's not normal.
No.
And that
and is now banned for
that
a reason.
That is part of the culture, though, here especially, and maybe here more than other places. I haven't lived in any places at that age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it is because I have moved around a lot. And I even think they're like, I lived in Dublin for a while. And I mean, the Irish can be crazy with their alcohol, but I actually had a group of friends that barely drank. My boyfriend was an Irish guy and he drank so little. I was like, these stereotypes aren't true. So I think Nova Scotia has a really toxic relationship with alcohol. I hope you don't have any alcohol sponsors. Because they might pull out.
We don't
know.
Why do you think that is the case with Nova Scotia?
I think starts from history times. Like it's an old sailing port. It's just kind of what you do. Fishing, that's a rough industry.
Yeah.
It just kind of became a
generational culture.
There you go.
Yeah.
Self-fulfilling. It's just, it's bad here. Now I've just moved back from London. I don't know what it's like. I don't go out anymore. I can say it was bad. And between 2005 to 2017, it was a rough city for alcohol and drugs.
At that age in particular, we can all remember what it was like to be in our teens or early 20s. Mm. And drinking was different then because you're a child and you're doing things for the first time and you're out with your friends and it's exciting. It might seem like a simple question, but what was it about alcohol that you liked?
I loved alcohol because it was an escape and I didn't have to feel how I felt. Because they say with addiction, whether it's a disease or it's a trauma response, there's a bunch of different schools of thought on that. It's about not wanting to be in yourself and like doing anything you can to not be inside yourself. And I think just from the trauma from my childhood, and then I'm accumulating more kind of really difficult situations and sexual assaults and things that come with drinking and being a young woman, then, you know, you're kind of just, you have more things you don't want to feel. And so then I'm drinking more, and then I get introduced to cocaine when I moved to the Valley and go to Acadia. And somebody was like, hey, we heard you just were living in California, because I'd been living in LA for a bit. They were like, so you must have done coke before. And I wanted to be so cool. And I was like, oh yeah, like totally all the time. And then, so we go to the party and this girl puts out a line and I do it. And I still remember like almost a decade and a half to 2 decades later, I remember that feeling of being like, wow, I have come home. When I had that first line of cocaine, it was like the angels sang. Mm.
You felt more at peace?
Yeah, I felt so at peace. And like, this is what I've been missing my whole life. I actually, when I tell this story, I kind of trigger myself, because like I always say, and I've said in interviews before, the love of my life was cocaine.
Yeah.
Everybody, boyfriends or people, would be like, you have to choose. You have to choose. Like, I had this boyfriend, Chris, when I was at Acadia, and he was like, you have to choose. It's between the two C's. It's Chris or cocaine. And I was like, bye, Chris. Like, peace, buddy.
Did you know while you were drinking and doing coke that you were covering something up, that you had these issues, these traumas from the past?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I was just kind of, that was just how I lived my life. And then when you're in deep in addiction, all your friends are the people deep in addiction. And then everybody's kind of poorly behaved and it just becomes super toxic. And yeah, that's how I lived my life. And in Halifax, you know, I went to Toronto for a bit and pulled all these geographics. Do you guys know what geographics are?
No.
Geographics are like in addiction when you like move somewhere else or change a career. And it's like just to like, you think you're going to leave the addiction behind, but where you go, there you are, or whatever they say. Mm. So I went to Los Angeles, Australia, South Korea, Ireland, and then eventually London to like try and escape myself, and I blame Nova Scotia. Do you know that song by the Bare Naked Ladies? The Hello City?
The one about hating Halifax?
yeah.
That's your anthem?
That was my anthem. I was like, what is it? They call it a seaside beer hall or something. And people would be like, oh, where are you from? And I was like, it doesn't matter. It's some seaside beer hall. And just like, but it wasn't the place. It was me.
As you were bouncing around to these new places, were you trying to stop using drugs?
Oh, yeah, I would. And South Korea was probably the longest I was ever clean, because you can't get cocaine there. But then instantly from South Korea, I moved to Bolivia and South America. So I really, really got to ramp things up there.
The South American pure from the source.
Oh, yeah. I remember in Bolivia, you could get cocaine thrown over a prison wall by like, because the prisoners would make it inside. And I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. I'm so happy.
Bolivia's awesome.
Yeah. No, I know. What? Like, it's madness. When you're in addiction, everything is just madness and you're never thinking straight. It's crazy.
What's the story about you getting kidnapped in Romania?
She didn't even mention that place on her list of where she had lived.
Oh, well, that was a backpacking. No, I was just, I was drinking a lot and backpacking through Europe, as I think a lot of us do. And then I had this goal to make it by land travel from Amsterdam to Istanbul. And I didn't really like look up any of the countries in between. I was just like, I'm 24. I'll just show up, figure this out. And then, I was getting off. I woke up, did this overnight train from Budapest to Bucharest. And I woke up and I was in the Carpathian Mountains and like, you know, Transylvania and that early fog. And it was beautiful. And I was like, oh, I'm in Romania now. Didn't Google it. I don't know if we had Google. Well, we had Google then, but didn't look it up at all. And when I got off the train, basically this like car was there and they're like, you missed all the other trains, because I was connecting to Istanbul through Bulgaria. You missed everything. Long story short, I end up getting in this fake government taxi. The guy's like, I'll take you to the bus station. And then we're driving out of the city. And he picks up another guy. And then they're like, right, so if you don't give us money, we're going to kill you for your passport. And we're just driving around. And I'm just like crying. And the reason I didn't like do any research on any of these countries is because I was just more concerned about partying. I didn't give a...
You're 24 and invincible, right?
Exactly. And I thought I was invincible for a really long time. But yeah, so in the end, I ended up like getting out of the car to go to this ATM to get out all this Romanian lei or the whatever the currency is. And we're on the outskirts of Bucharest. There's nobody around. I'm sobbing. I'm like, I'm going to die or I'm going to have no money. And then out of nowhere comes like a probably like a college kid, like a guy. And he just comes around a corner and he sees what's happening. And he chases them away, gets my bag, grabs me by the hand, and he like barely speaks English. And he's just like, right, I'm going to walk you to the bus station. So we walk like 30 minutes together through the city and he takes me to the bus station.
What an angel.
Yeah. I know, he was my little angel. And then, yeah, so those are just some of the situations.
Hey, Kristen, do you know what's awesome?
Theme parks? Cotton candy?
Well, yeah, but I was going to say saving money.
Saving money is awesome.
Well, the sponsor of this week's podcast episode, Ryan O'Malley with Allstate Insurance, can help you save money with home and auto insurance.
That sounds fantastic, but I don't like dealing with call centers and talking to like 30 different people.
That's the amazing thing with Ryan. You don't have to deal with a call center. You get to speak with someone local living in Cole Harbor who knows our area, our weather, our vehicles, and our housing needs.
Ooh, I love the sound of this. And with the money we will save through bundling our insurance with Ryan, you can take me to a theme park and buy me cotton candy.
We can buy anything you want with all the money we'll save.
I'm sold. Sign me up. How can I get in touch with Allstate Insurance?
Well, you can call Ryan O'Malley at 902-210-1293 or email romalley@allstate.ca. And he's been a fantastic supporter of local arts in our podcast, so we really give the thumbs up to Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan, for helping Nova Scotians save money while protecting the things that matter to us. You already have 108 five-star reviews on Google. Prepare for even more. Were you traveling on your own or moving on? Like, were you by yourself in these moves?
I was traveling on my own. I've always been really independent, and I'm an only child, and so I would just... I'd just get up and go. I've never been scared to dine alone or go to a movie alone or do anything alone. So, but it was really panicked my parents, I believe. I put them through severe stress for many years.
Yeah.
I remember traveling Central America. I was gone 9 or 10 months and getting home to the airport and both of my parents each grabbing an arm and pulling me outside to go to the car. And I was like, I have to get my luggage, you guys. Like, they were just so relieved and excited that I was home that it was just this big panic. Like, let's get her physically back into our home now.
Did you go by yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I met people end up traveling with. So yeah. I wasn't alone the whole time, but made that initial trip. And
we really are connected.
I know.
We are very similar.
I know. Well, maybe that's a good time to talk about, I don't want to interrupt this flow here, but how we met, really.
Yeah, let's do it.
Because that feels so just serendipitous that you came into our lives.
I know.
So you had put a public call out on through your social media account, which is a million times bigger now, but at that time, looking for an art gallery in Nova Scotia.
Yes.
So this was percolating that you wanted to do something back in Nova Scotia, despite your resentment for it in your past. So how did this story come to be?
So I was about September after I started the Instagram account, and I was like 5 months sober or whatever. And I was, so I guess we need to say that my career has always been in museums, and my PhD is in the very sunny topic of museum and genocide studies. So designing ethical exhibits to traumatic events. So I was on a train and I was going to a museum conference and I was kind of thinking about my recovery and this Instagram thing. And then I was thinking about museums and it kind of just hit me. I was like, oh my God, do you think there's a museum to like addiction and like everything? And I was started Googling and looking, and I couldn't really find anything. There's like a DEA American Museum, but I think it's like part of something, and it's just like, don't do drugs. Mm-hmm. Like, drugs are so bad.
So boring.
Yeah. And then I think there's a few more like smaller community ones, but overall, I couldn't find anything that was like a museum to addiction and that lived experience. And so just on the train, I came up with the Museum of Addiction and Recovery, and I cried. I was like, I think I found my life's purpose, because I love museums and I love talking about recovery and getting people sober. People always say online, what's your whole personality now? And I'm like, well, sure.
Great. Yeah.
Okay. So I started this, and then I was started designing the first show and curating. I mean, you're an artist. I'm not a great artist. I've dabbled, but I'm good at curating others' art and bringing it all together and getting the funds for that. And so then I was like, you know what? I feel like to heal, because my rock bottom and the reason I got clean and sober, which we haven't covered yet, happened in Halifax. And I was like, I feel like this would be really healing. And so I was like, but where would do it? And I put out a call for an art gallery. And, you know, I was just thinking, this, where could the museum be hosted for their first show? And then our friend Lindsay, mm-hmm, from the Float Center.
Yeah, shout out to Lindsay.
Former guest.
Oh, shout out Lindsay. Yeah, I love her. She connected us, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it was really my trust in her that I thought, because we had never met, I didn't know your work or your background. And I thought, well, yeah, if Lindsay's going to suggest this woman to share the space, then I'm all in. And we started talking, and you were just so lovely and positive and bright. And the idea is so important, especially in a place like Nova Scotia that we've talked about. And so I can't wait to host this show. Mid-August is going to be your opening.
August is
17th? Yeah, we're looking at each other like, shoot, does somebody know the answer to this?
Yeah, but, August 17th or 18th to 31st, down in Ingramport at Togetherland. And I think it's going to be really amazing. And also, we're kind of making it like a recovery, a few weeks of good recovery events too.
Yeah,
bringing community and hosting music. You know, obviously the music scene in Nova Scotia and the world has a lot of former people who struggled with addiction. Mm-hmm. So some of those artists are gonna play, and I think it's gonna be really cool 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's gonna be really special. I'm so grateful that you're gonna
be there.
It's
a magical place there, and every event seems to just bring out the best in people and just these amazing connections. So I'm very excited for it myself.
I think some of the artwork I have is from international and some based in England, because that's where I was kind of planning this from. And some of the artwork, guys, oh my God, it's so incredible. Like, it just, when it comes into my inbox, I want to cry. But Togetherland is actually a pretty big space, mm-hmm, and I really want to get the call out. May I do it here?
Of course you can.
Sure, yeah.
Nova Scotian artists, if you've struggled with substance use, I want to talk to you. I want to showcase your art. I want to showcase your story. And I want to do that at Togetherland.
Yeah.
And you can do that by visiting. Will we do it?
We'll put it in the show notes. Yeah.
Cool. But it's you can just Google Museum of Addiction and Recovery.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll put the links in if you want to contribute to that show.
Oh, it'll be amazing.
Do you have a deadline for when you'd like for those pieces to be?
May 20th, I believe, is my deadline.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. So there's still time to get on that. But so, yeah, that's a good little shout out. But we have also since learned that we have lots of other, be it mutual connections or people from our past. And I just really feel like we were meant to meet. And
I just love you. I absolutely adore you. And let me tell you, dear listeners, when I came back, I was not supposed to come home for Christmas this year. I was in London. I was hating Nova Scotia. And but we had just talked about the gallery, and I came to Mike's birthday party.
Yeah.
And I walked in, and what did I give you?
A gas card.
That is so practical.
I was like, I don't know anything about this man, but I'm going to get him a gas card.
Everybody likes a gas card.
Yeah. And you guys were so welcoming, and I just had my rock bottom had happened a few months earlier, and it was so horrifying, and just you were so welcoming and kind, and not, I just, the love you show people, it like, it sounds really lame, but you guys healed a part of me.
Oh,
I'm not blowing smoke. I really, really mean that. Like, I just want to do anything. I think you guys should have the biggest, best podcast in the whole world.
Well, thank you. But it really, I admired so much the courage that you showed up with at the gallery, not that day, but it was before or after that party. It was after that. Like, I knew who you, by this time, it's like, okay, like, Danny's coming over, but we weren't close.
No.
Like, we didn't know a lot about one another, but you very openly, vulnerably, and volunteered, reached out and said, there's something that I want to talk to you about, just to make sure that we're still on the same page to host this show at your gallery. And, you know, kind of asked me, like, is there anything that you've heard about me from my past? And I hadn't. I was just so touched by your willingness to step up and have this conversation with, like, almost a stranger on your own.
No.
That was so brave of you. And I sort of decided in that moment, like, whatever she has to say, it doesn't really matter to me, because I'm so impressed by her showing up and putting herself out there like this with my feelings in mind.
Yeah.
Like, that was your intention for being there on that day.
I didn't want to put you in a situation that was difficult for you. And I just, you were kind of a stranger to me, but also I just felt after that night at Mike's birthday, I really trusted you. And then Mike, you were there too, and just cleaning to avoid the conversation.
Like, I probably shouldn't be listening in on this.
I went over into the...
She just stood in the parking lot for like 15 minutes.
I went into the church. I sat in the church and I played the organ a little, and I just, you know, it's peaceful in there. And I knew, like, you didn't care, but I like, this is your guys' conversation and you guys... Do what you gotta do there.
Yeah, I guess we should explain just a little bit that my rock bottom in Halifax involved people who were connected to you in a little bit. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, people within our network,
music,
I guess.
Music network, you know.
Mike's a musician, so we tend to know other musicians.
Yeah, and I dated drugs, alcohol. There's a lot of that in the North End Halifax music scene. And so I was involved with someone who, you know, it was just toxic. And it's the reason, being with him is the reason I got sober.
We're not here to pry, but I think it's worth, to your level of comfort, just sharing about, and really we've kind of maybe glazed over of this history of how you arrived at that rock bottom. So why don't we start this story with, like, how you led up to that evening. So sort of like the depths of the addiction.
Let me get a bit comfy for this. My addiction was really bad. So, like, I started using at 20, and then the first time I went to a 12-step program, I was 27. And no, I don't want to give my age. I am timeless, everybody. But anyways, it was sometime in my 20s. I went to an AA program, and I was sober for like 4 months and relapsed. I was too young. And then over the course of a decade, I basically was in and out of rehab about, three times. Three inpatient, one outpatient. It's really bad when you lose track.
And were you choosing to go to rehab each of those times?
I chose. Wait, this is bad. I don't know. I remember one time, the third time, getting, it was in a rehab in like Middleton. And I like made mom pull over on the highway there. And I was like, I'm not going. But like, I knew I had to go. I got kicked out of that rehab though, because just poor behavior. So anyways, during the pandemic, my alcohol and drug use just got horrendously bad. And then I ended up moving to London and I got lonely and I was just doing drugs every day. I got cast on this reality show. I was in the paper, like the Sun newspaper and the Daily Mail. It was just like a lot. And I thought I was just so cool, just partying and reality stars. And it's big over there. People care about those people over there more than Canada. So I was just like living the life. And then Christmas 2022, I came home to see my family, and I went downtown on a fateful night my birthday is December 26th, and like nothing is open on the 26th.
Mike's is the 24th, yeah. So you guys both have this awful Christmas baby syndrome, huh?
The one present in syndrome.
So, so I get tickets to the show, and there's this musician playing there, and we kind of meet outside. I was kind of familiar with him, but not like overly, because he does like rock or whatever, and I was more into Britney and all those gals and pop music and the gay clubs and Reflection. So like I kind of didn't really know much about him or the bigger band he was a part of, and we just kind of he messaged me. We did drugs in a hotel. We started a situationship, and you know, lots of lies. He told me he was in an open relationship, and I didn't even know what an open relationship really was. I'd never been part of one. I never wanted to be part of one. If it works for you, it's great. I am way too self-centered and way too jealous. And like, long story short is that, you know, I ended up going back to England, and we kind of carried on this relationship, and I just fell like madly in love. And it was not to be. I came back to see him, and there was just a lot of lies and a bit of like trauma bonding, like where he would ghost me and then come back. And I was be very specific with my questions, like, because I'm, you know, even though I was doing a lot of drugs, I was kind of like aware of that men can be shitty. And so it's just like, what do you want? And it was always circular answers. So I just kind of got to this place where I was just like, did not know what was going on with this guy. And I was doing drugs, like so much with him and so much on my own to deal with those emotions. And then finally one night, I think you were both there. There was just this concert downtown, and I went to see him, and he was like, oh, my partner's here, I can't see you. And I just kind of snapped. I was like, this isn't a note. Like, what? And it's just been 3 months of this back and forth. I was just in a terrible place. And basically, I don't really want to get too into the details. You can get my book. But I ended up being assaulted by women connected to, I don't know, him or her. And, you know, I was listening to him sing on the stage, and these women came out of nowhere and beat the shit out of me. Well, not really. I mean, they were pulling me, scratching me, spitting on me. And, you know, I ran out of that venue, and I was sobbing. I could hear him singing behind me, and I got outside and just dropped to my knees. And I was like, what is this life that I'm living, where I'm around on these toxic situations? And you know, earlier that night when I was driving to the concert, I was going across the McKay Bridge, and I felt something like wet and warm on my face. And I just remember looking in the mirror, and my nose is like hemorrhaging blood. And in that moment, I remember being upset, not because I was like bleeding profusely, but because it was ruining my makeup. Like, that was the headspace I was in. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of snapped back into it, and was like, right, I got to get this concert. I got to see this guy. Like, I got to make this relationship work. And everything just went terribly. And that night, trigger warning, you know, after the concert, I went home and I tried to overdose. Like, I just said, I don't want to be here anymore. And I wasn't successful, thank God. And then I woke up, and everything was an absolute chaotic mess. And a few days later, I said, I cannot drink. I cannot do drugs. And I cannot continue living like this. Can't believe I didn't cry telling that story.
You did brilliantly. Thank you. That takes a lot of courage to recount that.
Sorry you had to experience all these things. Obviously, that's horrible that you had to go through this. And
it's okay.
There is the, like, you reference this as your rock bottom.
Yeah, it is.
And the thing is, you come across a lot of successful people or people in life who just went on to do great things. And often they do come to this point
Yeah.
Where everything is just a shit show, a disaster. Yeah. Something happens. It could be lost. They could lose someone in their life.
Yeah.
It could be, yeah, exactly what you went through. And from there, you set the foundations for everything to come.
Yep.
And I don't know. I don't know how you look back on that moment now, but that ultimately set you on this trajectory.
Yeah. I'm grateful.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'm grateful. There are still nights where I cry and think, why did I go that night? Like, I don't think I'd slept for days. I was serving burgers at Burger Week earlier and, like, definitely, like, doing coke at 11 a.m. Like, I was just a total mess. And, you know, sometimes I'm just like, oh, like, why? Because I was, you know, diagnosed with PTSD after the assault. And it took me a really long time to call it an assault because I always blamed myself for everything. But now when I say it strongly and with conviction that, you know, I was assaulted that night and I'm allowed to have trauma from that. And because of that night, you know, when I was in London, there was a market I always like to visit, Borough Market, and it's packed. And not twice, but thrice, I would go there with the intent of not having a panic attack, but anytime I'm in a crowd now, I'm just scared who's going to come out of the woodwork, who's around. And every time I went to the market with different friends, I just ended up crying and having a panic attack. And that is my life now. And I know there are people who know the names of those women and they are protected. And that's one of the things that really bothers me about this town still is like there are people who could really help me process that night who refuse to. And that's kind of, you know, in recovery, you try not to hold any anger or any resentment. And I've let go of a lot of things, but sometimes I still have resentment over that. Like, at least tell me their names so I'm not looking over my shoulder all the time.
Mm-hmm. You said something earlier that really resonated with me that I want to bring up now. Mm-hmm. You use the language of accumulating sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a really alarming thing as another woman to hear.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that happened to you. I wonder why was that night in particular the night that felt like the rock bottom and not those other moments before?
Yeah. Chris. Yeah, I don't know. No. Once I start, I cannot stop.
This is my fault.
No, I don't know. I didn't value myself as a woman. I thought that I was just a body for so long. So I just didn't care what happened to it, but like physically what happened to me. But I think this night was a physical assault by women, and it was a concept of pride and ego. Mm. And to an addict, our ego is everything.
Mm.
And I think that just broke it down so bad. Like that, it's really sad to say that after, you know, 3 bad sexual assaults that I never caught sober clean, that I never even registered it. It had to be something, like my sponsor always says, the events of March 31st, that night of my rock bottom, there were more just like everything that I valued ego-wise was ripped away from me, like a man who I loved and my safety and like who I thought I was. I don't know. And it's isn't that sad. And I think one of the things I try and do with my Instagram account, while it is for everybody, it is specifically written towards young women. And I try and have an account that I wanted to see that first time over a decade ago that I was trying to get sober.
Yeah.
I want to speak to those. I'm speaking to myself. And one of the things I really want to start highlighting is the addiction and sexual trauma or sexuality and being sober. But I find that is really challenging to opening up about online because I'm instantly slut shamed or, you know, women if a woman does anything on the internet, they're seeking attention. Mm-hmm. That's just what it is. Mm. And I try and be really ethical. Like, my PhD is in museum ethics. I try and be ethical about everything I do and everything I share. But sometimes the hate is just a little bit too much. And I do have to protect myself and my sobriety.
We see this. So I've referenced this before on the podcast. Mm-hmm. I used to work in politics, and I wrote a blog a few years ago about how politicians become sort of objectified, and that people think that they can say anything about them.
Really?
Because they're just somehow, once you take on this career role, not human anymore. Yeah. Appears as though, like, this is how they're treated. The same thing happens with celebrities. Mm-hmm. And now in this new age of social media, it happens with influencers, that you've entered this space of being an influencer. Okay. You have a lot of, yeah, I know that feels kind of like weird maybe, because it wasn't your intention starting out, but just to say you have a big following, because people, it's important, the story that you're telling. So people are curious about where this is leading and what tools they can get from that. But you're also, unfortunately, it opens up this whole world of people you've never even met that have the most vitriol things to say about you. And you're in year, like, entering just celebrating a year of sobriety. Like, I imagine this is a vulnerable space to exist in at the best of times. So how are you managing, like, the strength that it must take to stay in sobriety, to be working at the level that you are, the output that you're offering to the world, and now you're being faced with this criticism online?
Well, I am pretty strong, so there's that. And I spend my days studying war and genocide and famine, and I can really put myself and my story in perspective, I guess. I get a lot of hate, and it's just dumb. Like, it's always men. They're usually American. And they are always saying the same exact things. The biggest negative comment I get is always, "Oh, she got clean from drugs, but looks like she's addicted to lip filler now." And I'm like, I was addicted to lip filler before. And lip filler doesn't make me be a shitty daughter. So, like, just let me have my thing. Or always like, "Oh, she's a narcissist." All these things that women get thrown all the time. So the first time it happened, when I had a reel go viral, I was alarming. I was like, holy crap, there's a lot of hate out there. And, you know, very specific to me, men will say, like she's a dumb blonde bitch, or like, people will DM me to relapse, or I hope you relapse and drink yourself to death. And it's really taught me that, wow, humanity, we've got some problems. But it also shows me that what I'm doing is really important. And I've also learned that even though there is this 5% really hateful vitriol, there is 95% really kind, wonderful beauty coming from people. I just remember what I'm doing is more important than the hate. And people, you know, some people are just jealous. I can say it now.
Yeah. You totally can say that.
I can say it now.
You couldn't be farther from the truth.
And you've built a beautiful community where you have 100,000 supportive people who are learning from you. I'm sure there's some that you're learning from as well. And you make a post and there's hundreds of people commenting in the most positive way. And I know it's hard when you have 100 positive comments and one negative thing to not pay attention to that.
Yeah.
But what you've built up is an amazing thing. And in a short amount of time, really.
Yeah.
Like that's been skyrocketing over the last couple months, really.
I think one of the things that is most important is that I have a program. I work a program, a 12-step program of recovery, and I work it really hard. But of course, 12-step programs are anonymous, so I can't really speak about it on my social media platform. Mm-hmm. But it has changed my life. It gave me the tools to live selflessly and not ego-driven, because an addict is usually one of the most self-centered, egotistical people on the planet. And we all say that when we're sitting around. And the 12 steps just have helped me learned to forgive and not hold anger, and taught me how to live when I didn't know, because for like 17 years I was like 13, whatever, who knows what age I am.
It's on a sliding scale.
Yeah. So it's because I'm so connected and I have this amazing community of people in recovery, and I have close friends, and there's a bit of an on, like, I'm authentic to who I am online, but there's also, you know, a persona, and I have I'm really deeply connected as an authentic person to myself in my real life. And, you know, I wouldn't be able to share the things I do online without my friends and my family and just my 12-step community. And that every time I'm sharing online, because social media is kind of the antithesis of what a 12-step program is, because 12 steps, you decenter the self. And online, you center the self. So I really always have to check in, like, why am I posting this? Is this for my ego or is this to help other people? And it's a tough balance. And you have to kind of, you know, keep going back to it, make sure what you're doing is for the right reasons. And I can say, I'm doing it for the right reasons, guys.
You said that you wanted to create this account for your younger self when you were trying to recover the first time, if that's the right language.
Yeah.
What are the main things you would tell the younger Danielle?
God. Oh God, I don't know. Don't date musicians.
Good advice. Yeah, I'll agree.
Marry them.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. My dad's a musician. But he was the one who always told me that. I would say to myself, oh God, what a question, Mike. Jesus.
I think just what are the themes of, I guess, what you're putting out there?
Yeah. Well, just that, you know, the value in just authentically being yourself. You don't have to be someone you're not. You don't have to perform. You need to be whole within yourself. You're never going to find happiness externally. And besides my addiction to alcohol and drugs was also the addiction to men. And like that value that I got for myself was from men and other people. And I have to learn to be comfortable with yourself. And it's okay to kind of walk to the beat of your own drum. And the things I try and put out are just about self-respect. Well, they're everything. They're fun things from like what mocktails are great and where can you get a good mocktail, and you can still go out and you can still party and you can still have fun, but you can cut out all of the like trauma that comes with getting like blackout wasted at the Toothy Moose, which was after my time, so thank God. So just trying to show that you can have a very full life without alcohol and drugs, and life is very fun. And I will caution anybody in recovery, those first few months are grueling and you might feel like you are not having a single ounce of fun because your dopamine is so connected to outside sources. Getting clean and sober is a gift where you get to like then start making your own dopamine, your own happy chemicals, and then just general things in life become really fun. And you don't have to create this weird external validation life to feel good. You just feel good. Mm. It's like a secret I wish more people in Nova Scotia knew, because I think there's such a glamour to going out and having wine downtown. But I think, you know, 50% of people take it too far and wake up with regrets and shame. And as you get older, you get anxiety. If you do take it. Now, I am not telling people not to drink ever. That is not what my platform is. If you can handle it, by all means, I'm jealous of you. But if you can't, you know, there are other ways to live.
And I think this is the importance of people like you telling your story, is that it shows that this is the light that's on the other side of this.
Yes.
If you can manage to get through some of those harder days.
Yeah.
What was the first like week for you?
No.
Like?
Yeah, it was awful. So I was detoxing. I gave my parents down the street. I gave them my car keys and I said, don't let me out. By the way, if you are detoxing, please see a medical doctor. What I did was extremely dangerous. You should always be medically detoxed if you're physically addicted to anything, especially alcohol. but I locked myself in my childhood bedroom. And all I can remember about those first 2 weeks, besides crying and screaming into the beige carpet, was I decided to watch all seasons of this show, Yellowstone,
yeah,
which is a show I would never watch. And this is how out of it I watched every single episode of like six seasons of that show. I could not tell you one plot point or one character name. I do not remember a thing. I do remember Beth. But I was like,
And what was the rough guy's name?
I don't know. Nobody knows.
He was hot, though.
Who, the famous actor, Kevin Costner?
Well, Kevin Costner was like the lead.
Yeah. Like,
see, I barely know that.
This is like the bad boy in the show.
It was like he had a name.
How can I not? My high school
It was like
friends
a dog name or something. Like,
oh, yeah.
His name was like Ruff or something.
Yeah, I definitely don't think that's his name. But I. But yes, I just remember watching Yellowstone.
And are you look it up.
Are you Googling it? The cast? Yeah.
Yeah, we have to know.
But like, I don't think the show could be very good if I don't remember a single plot point of it.
I thought it was pretty good.
Oh, God. I'm sorry. Well, time to watch it again and like live stream my thoughts in sobriety.
So I said Ruff. I was pretty close. It's Rip.
Okay. Yeah. Is he the hot guy?
I don't know who you're considering hot. No, you probably think that guy's the hot guy, not Rip.
Ooh. See, I don't recognize any of these people. And I watched the whole show.
But this kind of speaks to maybe the state of mind that you were in at the time.
No, it was crazy.
I was
delusional.
And how quickly did you get into a 12-step program?
Oh, no, I did a bunch of crazy things first. I was like, I'm not going back to those church basements because I was like, they don't work for me. So I had to, I had to leave Nova Scotia and go on this research trip for my PhD. So instantly, I was in all these other places and I had to be really focused. So that actually was really helpful. When I came back, I just flew right back to London. And then I went to Spain and I did so many really insane things in early sobriety. Do not trust your brain. I remember I like got a realtor in Spain and I was like, I'm moving to Barcelona. Like what? And then
it's not that bad an idea.
Well, no, I know, but like I don't speak Spanish and I had a home in London.
Google Translate.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But I don't know what I was doing. I did so many. And, you know, I was still really addicted to this guy, this rock star. And, you know, he kind of, he represented, I didn't really think about using drugs or drinking. I thought about him a lot because I think he represented that whole lifestyle. And it took me an embarrassingly long time to get over him. And he is still like a drug to me. If I, I act like a very normal person in my day-to-day life, but anything that comes to, if he'll pop up or message anything to do with him, I am instantly insane. Mm. I think girls can relate to this, or maybe Mike can relate to it.
Very heavily shaking my head. Yes. Yeah.
It's like, I'm totally pretty normal and cool, but like, nope, if he comes around or is mentioned, I'm insane. And, that's why, you know, like you with an addiction, you be addicted to anything. And it's so important not to replace the addictions in early recovery. You've just got to like really, yeah, maybe I think my Instagram platform was an outlet for me. And obviously I'm grateful for it because all the other times when I was in recovery, I was really secret about it. And this time, like if I relapse now, God, I'm so fucked, guys. I got everything riding on this.
And you're celebrating your first year.
When does this podcast come out?
It will be the day after your anniversary. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, what a huge milestone.
You guys are coming to my party.
We're coming to celebrate
I guess this is out the day after my party.
Yep.
Oh, Sober Barbie.
Sober Barbie.
Mike's playing some tunes.
I'm going to sing with Jackson. Yeah.
Yeah. You guys.
I'll just jump up and sing with him a couple. Yeah.
Do you know Michelle Skelding? She was in Like a Motorcycle.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's going to sing a song there too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love, shouldn't be shitting on musicians. I love a ton of them. And they're the best people. We all are the best people in the world. So yeah, we got a nacho station. Come on.
A nacho station?
Definitely be there.
Yeah.
I want to ask you. I have some more questions here.
Yeah.
I want to ask you. Are there positive memories from this time in your life, despite being an addict, that you miss? That you feel contributed to the woman that you've become today?
Mm. Oh yeah, Yeah, I miss all of it. I'd be lying if I told you that I don't miss the chaos. Any addict in early recovery would be, well, no, I can't speak for them. Oh, I miss all of it. Mm. I feel like I had to rebuild a whole new person. I didn't even know who I was. I started drinking at 17 and really went off to the races for like 20 years. I didn't really know who I was. I feel like I lost myself. I feel like I was great at being a party girl. I had a reputation. I was wild. I was fun. I wasn't an angry drunk. I was generous. I was a great, great time for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had so many good times. I've lived a crazy, wild life. I partied with, I don't want to get you sued or me sued.
We won't get sued.
One of the Lohan and I, we had great times in LA. You know, I've made out, my favorite movie is Jurassic Park. I've made out with one of the leads from Jurassic Park in a Beverly Hills jazz
club.
The
guy who played Newman on Seinfeld?
No, ew. How dare you? How dare you? No.
I know who it actually is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a great time and it, of course I miss it. I miss it a lot, but those days are done and those days are not as they are remembered in my mind. There was so much sadness and like coming down from cocaine as you get older, you're in bed for 2 days, you're rotting, you're staring at the ceiling, you're eating junk food. Listen, I'm going to come off as a real nerd, but even doing a little bit of cocaine, it rots your soul. It brings you to your knees. And I hate it as a drug. And I wish it did not exist. Now, I don't have any experience with opioids or fentanyls here. And they're mixing that in with cocaine. It's so dangerous, guys. If you're getting coke or whatever downtown, oh, it's so dangerous. You don't know what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
I hate cocaine. I really, really, really hate it.
Have you reconciled with some of these people from your past that you've talked about?
Listen, one of the biggest things that happened out of my rock bottom is that I lost my relationship with basically my sister, my cousin, who lives in Halifax, and we grew up basically as sisters, and there's just a bunch of fallout from everything that happened, and we haven't really spoken for a year. And that is the greatest, greatest loss. And I miss her terribly. But when you have injured somebody so many times and made so many promises, it takes a lot of time to heal. I've done a lot of my amends, and most people were all cool and whatnot. But it's a lifelong, like since moving back, like I should say my house burned down in London.
Yeah. Right. Then that happened.
Yeah, that happened, what, a month ago? About a month and a few days ago?
Yeah.
And that's why I moved back. Yeah, so I've just been walking around. Like, even out here, I went into a bakery and I saw a girl that I used to, like, bully online. And I was like, walked up to her. I was like, I have to make an amends. And I was trying to think, like, why did I hate this girl? Because when you're an addict, you just hate everybody. And it was because she sold like multi-level marketing vitamins online. And I like really hated that and like needed her to know that what she was doing. But like, that's none of my fucking business.
Mm.
Who cared? But like, I had all these problems with everybody. And so now it's just been a revolving door of, oh, hey, listen, I got to tell you something. And then I'm like, I'm a year sober. And then when you do an amends, you just take accountability. You don't hum and haw and blame other people. You just take accountability. The one person I really, you know, the rock and roll star, so to speak, I'd love to have a face-to-face with him, but, you know, that's not possible. And I'd love to have a face-to-face with my sister, but that's not possible right now. But, you know,
how did most people react in making these amends?
They're so happy. They're so proud of me.
Yeah.
If you just, like, I'm a really nice person. I just had a really bad drug addiction. They're so happy for me. I got plans to hang out with some of them. I'm just a more confident person. And I'm, besides, like, these people, I'm attracting new friends who honestly, yeah, genuinely want to be around you. Addiction keeps your world so small.
Mm.
And now I just feel so blessed. I keep meeting people like you. Like, but I sometimes think I don't deserve people like you in my life. Do you know what I mean? Like, I still feel like I don't deserve the goodness around me and the good things that are coming to me. And I still, I hear the negative voices of my critics, but my main critic is myself in my head. And then I always think, oh, if what I'm doing, what I'm sharing, isn't making me look crazy. Like, you know, I'm sure people could say a lot and have always said a lot of things about me, but I kind of know who I am now, and I like me. Oh my God!
and you do deserve all the good in the world. Like, well, you're putting that back. You're putting good out there now, and it's coming back for you in every way.
Is this a therapy session or a podcast?
A little bit of both. Yeah. Are you happy to be home? Does it feel like home again?
I am so happy. When I got sober, the more sobriety I got in London, you know, I wanted to be in England, in London especially, because it's like glamorous and all those external things. But the more sober I got, I was like, oh no, I don't actually want any of this. And but I wouldn't. I've been sharing this in meetings. My ego wouldn't let me come home. Because if I was in London from the little town, I was somebody. And my ego wouldn't let me come home. And I think the universe had to actually
set your house on fire.
Set my building on fire, even though it was arson, actually. It was arson.
Really?
But I had to burn my life down to go, okay, I hear you. I was such an atheist before. I'm not religious, but like there's some power up there. There's a reason I met that rock star. There's a reason I was hit over the face with a sledgehammer on March 31st. There's a reason my house burned down. And there's a reason I'm back here. I was building this community and focusing on maybe building the Museum of Addiction in London. But it's this community in Nova Scotia that I want to serve. My ultimate goal after, you know, Togetherland is, and I know I sound insane, but I just want to have a brick and mortar space for the Museum of Addiction and Recovery. I want it to be a place you can come and not drink. I want it to have, you know, not 12-step meetings, but community recovery meetings. I want it to showcase art. Did I say music? You know, I want all of that. That's what I want. I want to help people here in my hometown. I don't care about, I'm glad that it tricked. I'm glad that I'm an international superstar, obviously. But like, I want to help people here. And that's the goal, is somehow learn how to run a nonprofit. There's just so many things I have to learn because I spent so long in addiction, but I'm looking at it as more like an exciting thing. If anybody is listening to this and like knows anything about nonprofits, please get in touch with Kristen and Mike.
There you go.
Help me out.
You'll be hearing.
Yeah.
What feels possible to you now that didn't to you before?
Everything. Mm. Everything. I hated myself for so long. I didn't think I deserved anything. And now I think I deserve the world. And all I've ever wanted was love. But I couldn't keep it because either I was too scared of commitment, or I was attracted to the wrong people, or I was a mess. And I've been the terrible person in relationships where people have left me like, what the fuck? Like, but now I think that love might be possible. You know, I am a kid of the 80s. I did watch all the Disney movies. I do want that happy ending. But like, if you don't know yourself, if you don't love yourself, you can't ever attract real love. So I'm not dating right now, but, you know, in time I will get there and I will maybe find my guy and we'll all have a really fun. I feel like my wedding dresses are going to be so good. Like, if you are out there as a man listening and you want a hot wife, well, I'm your girl.
She's not wrong. What you have done in such a short period of time, in my eyes, I'm sure there were moments that this last year has felt like an absolute lifetime times a thousand, but it's just so moving. You know, I'm fortunate that addiction is not something I personally myself have struggled with. It's in my family. It's in, I'm sure, lots of our families on the East Coast, as you referenced. I think your story is relatable to people in lots of areas of their life.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have to be specific to what you went through, but the stories you tell and the way that you show up, just about moving on and knowing yourself and bettering yourself, like, these are all inspiring stories. We've talked about
your social media account being such a beautiful platform to people to go to, pursuing a PhD, opening a museum specific for people that are struggling with this. Like, you have all of this, all of these gifts to give, and you're very giving with them. I just want to acknowledge that and congratulate you and thank you. And you have really evolved into, you know, Danielle 2.0. So yeah,
I know.
Welcome to the world, my love.
Oh, guys, oh, I just love you both so much. It hurts me.
The world is yours to take over here, Danielle.
Well, let's all take it over together.
Yeah, we're working
on
it.
That's our plan.
Yeah. Is there anything that we've missed from your story that you would like for listeners to hear?
I want to give a shout out to my two cats, Waffles and Nibbles.
There you go.
They are my little besties, and we've been reunited, and we are having the best time down at my parents' house.
Are they living with you in your new place?
I couldn't take them away from my father.
It would for his sake.
It would kill him.
Yeah, okay.
So I come out for visits, and depending on the snow, I might go down.
Coming down now.
Yeah, are you going to brush my car off, Mike, or am I doing that?
If you want me to. I'll make you a cup of tea and then I'll go out and you guys can chat.
Oh, bless you.
Great.
We love that.
We get a fire on. We're cozy here.
Yeah. I just, I love you both. I have nothing else to say but a big thank you for what you guys have created and believing in me. And I'm so excited for this summer. Let's
rock and roll.
Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, okay. I'm ready to rock and roll again. Let's rock and roll. Yeah.
Sure, I knew. Yeah, I thought you were ready. I wanted to go there.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be, it can be your own definition, right? It can be whatever you define rock and roll as. I can be opening an awesome exhibit at a gallery and having friends around and sitting by the water at night looking at the stars, you know?
That sounds pretty rock and roll to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sweet. We'll be there. Well, thanks everyone for listening again. Thank you for opening up today, Danny.
Yeah, it means a lot.
Danny Mega. That's what we call you around here. Danny Mega's coming over.
At Danny Mega.
Yeah.
Like and subscribe.
All the links are in the show notes.
Okay. Thanks so much, bud. What a good chat.
She is a light in the world, and I feel really grateful that we get to spend this time together and deepen our friendship, and hopefully this resonated with some folks out there.
Oh, definitely. And again, there's that call for artists she's looking for, so get in touch if you want to be involved in the show at Togetherland.
Yeah, so what about you? What do you have on the go, on the horizon, in the past that you want to highlight?
Well, I just put out my new single, Olden Days.
Another one out
to the world right now. I'm pumping out the singles, going hard in the paint, as they say. And it's, getting a pretty good response. People seem to enjoy it. And
what's the inspiration behind Olden Days?
I wrote it in Colombia at Arta Sumapez retreat there. I remember it was just sitting there looking at the... I have a bunch of the voice memos and you can hear all the bugs and the wildlife and the creatures. It's,
bugs in Colombia?
There's no silence in Colombia. It's a nice sound, though. Mm. But there's just birds chirping and just creatures all around you in the song. But yeah, the song is kind of about just thinking back to old memories in the past and just the nostalgia that can come over you from that, and kind of just sinking into it and letting it be a good thing.
It's another banger, and I love how you've released this song that is reflecting on the past in the same week that the solar eclipse happened here, because that feels so futuristic to me. So there's kind of this juxtaposition of the art that we're inspired by.
That wasn't intentional.
but it's the divine timing of it all.
Yeah.
Is that it feels extra special that way. And the eclipse can feel like new beginnings, which again, I feel is relative to this week's episode with Danny being so inspiring with her new beginnings. And I hope that everyone else out there is feeling that energy as well.
Yeah. Do you have anything you want to mention?
Just the gallery's opening on May 11th, so I'm working hard to get together the event schedule. I just launched an Instagram page for Togetherland Art Gallery, so you can follow along with hours and upcoming events, that sort of thing. And we're wrapping up the final week of the Artist's Way today with my collaborators with the Curiosity Club, who have been on the show. So there's kind of a lot of things coming to an end. and lots of new beginnings.
Sounds awesome. Well, let's, thank everyone out there for tuning in. You're awesome people. Much love to you, and more episodes to come, folks.